Now, with all that, please join me in welcoming Father Bud Grant.
I can tell there's a lot of Catholics here because the front row is still empty.
They'll be coming about halfway through.
Yeah. We're going to take up a collection, by the way.
Thanks.
Thanks for driving in, and Chad Gravy is somewhere. Thanks for driving him in from the Quad Cities. Bud, you've done a few things in your life. You're a Catholic priest, you're a farmer, theologian, soccer coach at the college level, a Roman tour guide, an environmentalist, an author, and the list goes on. Can you take us back to the beginning? What were your earlier influences that guided you to what you do today?
Yeah. Oh, when I hear that question, the first thing that comes to my mind is, and I'm not kidding, 60s protest music. I was a kid at the time and listening to that music and taking it all in. My brother was in Vietnam at the time. And I think it really did have an influence on me, but I understand that's a pretty superficial answer. Being rural, Midwestern, seventh of nine kids, grew up in a farmhouse, and every Friday we would get down on our knees in the living room and pray the rosary with mom and dad. And growing up through the Catholic school system, I think those are that, and more recently, my parents buried three of their sons before they themselves passed away. Those sorts of things, I think, leave a mark on a guy for the good, I think, overall.
You grew up in Council Bluffs, Iowa.
Yeah, we moved into town when I was still a kid, yeah.
And ended up at St. Ambrose University and then Rome for four years.
So I attended St. Albert the Great Central Catholic High School. You have to say the whole thing. Then I attended St. Ambrose College at the time, and then I attended the Gregorian University in Rome. Then when I became a priest, I was a priest in three rural communities. I was a pastor 6 weeks before I was ordained a priest because they were that desperate. You could tell they were desperate because they ordained me. Then I went back and taught the same high school I graduated from. Now I'm teaching at the same university that I graduated from, so I figure the next stop is the Vatican.
So how would you describe for us this morning what exactly you've been doing really over the last two decades? And yeah. Then what's happened this summer?
Yeah, oh my. I, when I lived in Italy, I used to give tours of Rome, spent more time in the streets of the city than in the classroom, to be terribly honest. And when I got back to America, the Midwest, I realized, I don't know anything about this place that I'm from. So I thought, I need to learn the history of this place, but, you know, we're too young of a country to have much of a history, so I started getting into Native American culture. And that led me out here, actually, to South Dakota, to Pine Ridge. And camping trips and hiking trips and backpacking trips over the years, and trying to learn from the Lakota, the traditional culture of the Lakota. And getting into social justice, there was a farm crisis in the 1980s. I was a pastor in three rural communities, so we were doing farm protests. Unfortunately, the people that we were trying to protest for didn't really appreciate it very much. I was picking up on this spirituality and this social justice, and I started realizing that my love of nature needs to be folded into this. So I started doing environmental ethics. I did my doctorate in St. Thomas Aquinas and the environment, which of course is such an obvious fit. Everybody could see that one coming. And started writing about it and lecturing on it, doing workshops, working for the Master Naturalist Program, and then when the Pope wrote this encyclical, it's like, this is my day in the sun. Somebody finally cares about what I do, at least for a few weeks, and then I'll go back into hibernation.
And a few weeks has been a few months and dozens of
conversations. Yeah, it's been amazing, and I will say it's remarkable because it's not just Catholics that are interested in this stuff. I've spoken at three universities so far. I've spoken with secular groups. I got invited to give a talk at a conference on urban sustainability, which has nothing to do with the church or God or anybody, but they wanted to hear about this stuff. I spoke to the Unitarians, for crying out loud. Of course, they'll listen to anybody, so.
So can we go back? You mentioned in the 80s, the farm crisis and protesting. And those protests, those that you were protesting for maybe not being open to that? Can you talk a little bit about
that? I don't know if you all know this out here, but rural Midwesterners tend to be a conservative lot, and they believe in... nobody here, of course. But they don't appreciate activism. It seems a little bit suspicious to them, even when it's done for them and in defense of their way of life. In the 1980s, we were losing family farms at a terrible attrition. By now, you know, after World War II, fully half of all Americans lived on the land at the end of World War II. By the 1980s, it was down to 2%. And I'm sure it's way down below that now, though I haven't been marking it as carefully. And the move to these big, massive factory farms and industrial grade farming has really taken its toll. So that's what we were kind of aware of and afraid of. And but again, rural people don't really like that business of going out to the county courthouse and rallying and that sort of thing. Didn't go over very well.
So why did you do it?
Well, some things you do because it's the right thing to do. And it doesn't... You got to be... I mean, let me back up just a little bit. When I lived in Italy, my sister lived there at the same time. My sister and her husband and her two kids. Tori, my brother-in-law, was a naval attaché assigned to the embassy. So we lived there for 4 years. It was really wonderful and really remarkable if you think about it. But as I was leaving, my sister gave me the best piece of advice anybody's ever given me, which was when you go out there to the countryside, to these farmers, don't talk so much as listen. And I did. I learned more in those 4 years I spent in rural America than I have learned in St. you know, at the Gregorian University in Rome or just about any place else. So I did learn a lot from them. And there's an attitude. There's a rural attitude of, you know what the right thing is to do? Do it. Or as one kid, I was here at a confession recently, a young farm kid, and he's sitting there and his elbows are down and his knees like he's milking a cow and he's talking and he's confessing. And I said, well, do you mind if I make a comment? And he kind of looked at me and he goes, have at her. And there is that attitude, have at her, just do it. Just go get done what needs to be done. So that's what I was doing, just doing what I think needed to be done.
So we want to get to the encyclical, but before we move on to more climate conversation, is it true you... partnered with Willie Nelson?
Well, not that would not be an overstatement. During the heart of the farm crisis, I discovered cloth feed sacks, which were a big deal in the Depression. And I was told by some of the local people that during the Depression, they would take these feed sacks and cut them apart and sew them back together and make bedclothes and sheets and pillowcases and even dresses and things like that. And the manufacturer of these bags knew this was happening, so they would design into the weave some colorful threads so that people could use it for decorative purposes. It was really nice of them to do that. So I just started asking around. The next thing I know, I ended up with a garage full of, you know, thousands of these feed sacks. So I started my own sweatshop. That's what one does. We got the local women of the community and me, and we boiled these bags so that they wouldn't lose their advertising on the bag. We cut them up and we stitched them up and we sold them for $50 a shirt, and we raised a lot of money to give to farm families, which if you think about it, that's how bad it was. I'm taking groceries and money to farmers. That's how bad it was in the 80s. So we sent one to Willie Nelson. The second or third farm aid was in Lincoln, Nebraska. So we sent a delegation down to give him a T-shirt, thinking it would be great PR. Mm-hmm. don't even know if you got it, to be honest. But that was our Willie Nelson experience.
Thanks, bud. So we're here to talk about the environment. Specifically, ultimately, we want to get to the encyclical. Before we do that, there's been a lot of conversation and politics by the politicians, especially during the presidential, this election year, about climate change. And I just want to ask very directly, is climate change real?
Okay, it's real, it's anthropogenic, that means it's caused by humans, and it's advanced. And those three facts are irrefutable. As a matter of fact, in the encyclical, the Pope mentions climate change 12 times, 6 times in 2 paragraphs. And the reason he mentions it so infrequently is because he doesn't see that this is a matter of contest. It's a fact. Let's deal with it and move on. So, yes, it's real, it's advanced, and we are largely responsible for it.
You've spoken over 40 times since July. You were in Iowa at the press conference when the encyclical was announced or shared in the United States. You've been on CBS Nightly News. You've been quoted in papers across the country. You'll be at Simpson University next week. Iowa legislators have invited you next week to talk about this encyclical. Will you give us a summary of the encyclical?
Of the encyclical?
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'll do it as quickly as I can. There's 6 chapters. The first chapter is he talks about the fact that there are environmental crises that are very real and advanced. And he makes a balance between what he calls a natural environment and social environment. And by the way, when he uses the word social, when you're going to read this thing, because y'all are going to read it, right? When he says social, that's a packed word. It means political, economic, social, cultural, as well as social. He means all of those things by that word. To talk about social environment means to talk about the human cost, particularly for the poor and the marginalized and future generations. And then he talks about the natural environment. In the second chapter, he talks about the role of technology. Specifically, he's very, very concerned. Sometimes I almost think he's a Luddite, but he backs off of that. But he's very, very concerned about our reliance, and he would say over-reliance on technology. From there, he talks about the need for political change, and then he talks about what we can do at the local level and what needs to be happening at the international level. And then he ends with this beautiful, profound, and very deeply religious and spiritual evocation, talking about God who creates, and then the Trinity, and then he goes from there to Christ and the Incarnation and the Word made flesh, that is to say, earth, matter, and the Spirit united. And from there he gets into this Catholic understanding of the Eucharist. And then he ends up beautifully. The guy can write. The guy is amazing. He starts with talking about Mother Earth, and he ends by talking about Mary, the Queen of Creation. So it's, just like beautiful bookends.
And how often does...
By the way, that's the shortest I've ever done that.
How often does the Pope actually write an encyclical?
Oh, I don't know. This is his second, I believe. Popes, the primary job of a Pope is to teach. And an encyclical is the Pope saying, right, here it is, you all are obliged to take this seriously. By you all, he means Catholics. But in this encyclical, he addresses it to every, I think the quote is, all people on earth. He addresses everybody. He's not just talking to Catholics. As a matter of fact, he quotes a 14th century Muslim mystic theologian. He quotes the patriarch of Constantinople, which is Istanbul, as often as he quotes Catholic sources. So he's really trying to reach in the encyclical. Yeah, he quotes very few people, actually. I'm a little offended because one of my best friends is Thomas Aquinas, and he mentions him only twice in the whole encyclical. So he's really trying to reach out to everybody.
Is that unique?
Let's face it, this guy's unique. He's something else. I happened to be in St. Peter's Square the night he was made Pope. And when he came out on the balcony and said, He goes, I'm going to offer you my apostolic blessing, but before I do that, I want you to bless me. And then he went down on his knees. And there were 50,000 people there, and the place was silent. And then you saw 50,000 hands go up in the air offering this man his blessing. And you realize, this is different. This is going to, and his name is Francis, for crying out loud. This is going to be a different pontificate, and it has been. It is so far.
So, take this to this room. The encyclical means what?
Encyclical means, it's just a fancy word meaning a formal teaching that Catholics are supposed to take seriously. And this is the first ever encyclical on the environment. So it's kind of a big deal for us.
And when you've spoken over 3 dozen times on this, what's your common message?
Relationship. A copy of the encyclical was leaked to the Italian press 3 days before it was officially released by some journalist who had it in for the Pope, and he thought he could sort of steal his thunder. I'm so glad he did that, because I happen to read Italian, so I got the encyclical 3 days before anybody else. So I'm pouring through it, and I'm sending messages out to the other people in this that are going to participate in this press conference, sort of giving them a heads up, here's what this is about. And I got halfway through the encyclical, and I remember on my computer I changed ink to red, just to write myself a note, like, why is he not quoting Thomas Aquinas? He's not quoting anybody. He's not. What is his theological foundation for all of this stuff? And then I just got a chill, and I realized he is creating a new theology. Thomas Aquinas talks about recta ratio, right reason. And that is to say, if you think it through, if you use your noggin, you're probably going to make the right choice. And if you end up making the wrong choice, go back, use your noggin, and figure out where you went wrong. Recta ratio. This Pope is talking about recta relatio. He uses a word or a cognate of the word relationship almost 300 times in this encyclical. It is all about relationships. Relationship to the earth, economic, social, political, cultural relationships, and are all really relationship with God. It's fantastic.
So I want to get back to the relationships, but before we do that, is there anything in this encyclical that you wish the Pope would have focused on?
Yeah, there is a couple things. Two things. One is the Catholic social teachings began a long time ago, and it's always been about concern for the poor, concern for the needy, concern for the marginalized, the fringe of society. The Pope, in writing this encyclical, says, I'm just adding one more layer to this. I'm going to talk about our relationship to nature. But by bringing in the social ecology, I'm a little concerned that he might be accused of diluting or not focusing quite enough on our relationship to the natural world. I don't think he does that, but there's that. He's balancing things like that. By the way, Benedict XVI in Caritas in Veritatem, paragraphs 42 to 45 or something like that, that's a mini encyclical on the environment, and he is in a sense much even more forward than Francis is on this. So that's one thing, but it's not a big deal because he does take it seriously enough for sure. But the other thing is, I don't know if you all know this, but the Catholic Church has an opinion or two on birth control. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. I wish he would have addressed that. He mentions overpopulation, I think, six times, most of it in two consecutive paragraphs, in which he says, quite rightly, that those of you who want to blame ecological problems on overpopulation are really just dodging your responsibility for over-consuming. Mm-hmm. And he's absolutely right about that. But I wish he would have taken the opportunity to explore just a little bit the Catholic understanding of family and marriage and relationships in that sense, as opposed to just sort of leave it dangling there for other people to criticize him for. So I wish he would have taken that. Wish he would have pursued that just a little bit. By the way, the main problem is not climate change. The main problem is overconsumption, as far as the Pope is concerned. If we stop overconsuming, all these ecological crises will begin to mitigate, including climate change.
Will you talk more about the overconsumption? I think in one of your talks, you shared that 8 Bangladeshi children consume the equivalence of 1 U.S.
Yeah.
child.
Yeah.
Can you speak about that?
Well, it's a little bit hard for us to blame the developing world for having too many kids when, as you just said, is it 8? I thought it was 7. Statistics don't stick with me. Always have to look this stuff up. But you get the point. If we consume 8 times what a Bangladeshi consumes, then we really can't blame them. If everybody wanted to consume at the rate of America, we would need 7 planet Earths in order to consume at that rate. So we really do. The problem is ours, and it is about consumption of resources.
So we're Americans, or most of us are Americans in the room. And I think we always think we're being talked to.
Or we what now?
We're being talked to, or maybe...
Preach that?
Is the Pope talking to us?
Yeah. Yeah, he is. He's... By the way, this is another thing about this guy. He's not talking top-down. Even though an encyclical is an official teaching that we're supposed to take seriously, he doesn't say, all right, here it is, guys, here are the answers. What he says is, all right, guys, it's time for us to have this conversation. It's overdue. Let's start having a conversation about this. And right there in paragraph 3 or 4, what he says is, I want to inaugurate a conversation. And he is talking to us. And it is working. A study was done recently, just completed a couple weeks ago. They knew that the foresightful people, they surveyed Catholics, mainstream Protestants, evangelicals, and then sort of a random group of Americans. And they asked them about their a number of questions about climate change. And then they waited until the encyclical came out, the Pope came to America, the Pope visited the United Nations, and then the Pope went home, and then they repeated the survey. The Pope seems to have moved the needle about 11 percentage points across the board.
Not just Catholics,
everybody. For the second time since the conversation about climate change has started in this country, only for the second time have the majority of Americans accepted anthropogenic climate change.
Okay,
and by the way, Catholics, 81%, so that makes us cool.
We're in an election year.
Uh-huh.
And if you watch a debate, it seems like there's a big struggle with the potential leaders of the United States.
Yeah.
And some of them say they're Catholic. Do you want to say anything about that?
Well, yeah. There's three kinds of politicians when it comes to environmental problems. There are people who get it and who want to do something about it. There are people who claim that they don't get it or don't believe in it or don't think it's a big deal because they believe it's to their political advantage to do so. And then there are people who genuinely, truly believe that there are no problems and that it's all some sort of a conspiracy. I think we have an obligation to support the people who say that it's real and will make the difficult choices. By the way, we're going to have to vote for people who are going to tell the stuff we don't want to hear because we have to change this stuff. The second category, we need to convince them that it's in their best political interests that they do not continue to deny the realities of ecological crises. And the third category, quite bluntly, we should not vote for them. They're dangerous. How's that for an opinion or two? If people applaud, then other people are going to feel free to throw things. So I think it'd be better if we just...
Hopefully they have good aim. To hit you, not me.
I got it. I'm thinking, how can I dodge behind you?
So take a step back here and put a little bit of perspective to this when looking at an encyclical. 125 years ago in 1891... Pope Leo XIII wrote an encyclical, Rerum Novarum. Close.
Outstanding. Best you've done all day.
And which has, over the last 125 years, been a major influence in social justice. Mm-hmm. That certainly has impacted my life, and I think thousands and ten thousands and millions of people. Yeah. Where, if you look out and consider this Pope's encyclical, yeah, what place in history does it have?
The Pope Francis explicitly connects this encyclical, Laudato Si, to Rerum Novarum and all of the other, they're called social encyclicals, and they've been coming out in a regular rate. In fact, the name of some of these encyclicals, if you look at them, Quadragesimo Anno was written on the 40th anniversary. Centesimus Annus was written at the 100th anniversary. The Catholic Church itself recognizes that Rerum Novarum triggered a new dimension of Catholic teaching that was addressing social ills. Rerum Novarum means new things. And Leo is not talking about, you know, the latest detergent as a new thing. He's talking about the threat of the oligarchs owning all the land, and the threat of communism providing an atheistic alternative to the oligarchy. And he wanted to establish as a norm that the working class have a right to unionize. He never uses the word union. He says they have a right to gather in community. But what it's code for unions. And from there, we've been building up. So this Pope explicitly says, I'm just tacking on one more chapter to this great tradition of the social encyclicals. It's time that we started being concerned about the plight of the planet itself. So, yeah.
You've spoken a lot, and you mentioned earlier that the burden of this, or the responsibility of this, the obligation of what the Pope is saying, isn't on the poorest of the poor, but yeah, on the ones that have.
The ones that have.
And you have a nice way, one of your talks, I saw a nice way of how you talk about taking that responsibility, that yoke.
Yeah. Yeah, This is the Pope's idea, but it's my articulation of it. I just think of Joseph of Arimathea, which of course you all know is a guy that helped Jesus carry his cross. So I have this idea. I use a phrase. Just lost it. It's my own phrase. I just lost it. Redistributive suffering. The Popes talk about redistributive justice, meaning that resources ought not be sequestered by the very wealthy. So I have this idea of redistributive suffering. Since, let's use climate change as an illustration. Climate change is real, it's anthropogenic, and it's advanced. IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, stopped about 10 years ago, they stopped using the vocabulary that says, let's turn this around so that this doesn't happen. Now they're using the vocabulary adapt and mitigate. Adapt and mitigate. If you went to a doctor and the doctor says, I have good news for you, I can help you to adapt and mitigate to your condition. That's not the best news. But that is the best news that we have right now. This vocabulary has been picked up by NASA. It's picked up by the EPA. It was actually used by President Obama in his second inaugural. He used the words adapt and mitigate in his inaugural address. It's kind of a big deal. So this is the situation that we are now in. Suffering, ecological suffering is happening. There are three primary victims: the planet itself, the marginalized, and future generations. Children born now will live in a world that's so different than the world that we grew up in that we won't even recognize it, and they won't know what they are missing. So the planet itself, the marginalized of today's society, and future generations. Since this suffering is real and advanced, and it's largely caused by our overconsumption, it seems to me that it becomes a moral obligation for us to shift the burden off of their backs and bear it ourselves. It's just the right thing to do. And there is this sort of, I don't know, almost a Machiavellian side effect. I always tell my students, if your roommate says she has a toothache, you're like, oh, I'm really sorry, can I get you a cup of honey tea or something? But when you have a toothache, you call 911. You get the National Guard out to deal with this pain. If we suffer the pain, all of a sudden we realize, oh, we kind of got to do something. By the way, nice day out today. Nice work, South Dakota.
So if we go back to Pope Leo XIII's encyclical, he writes, in practicing the rights of private individuals, however special consideration must be given to the weak and the poor.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that it sounds very similar to what Pope Francis is saying, what you're saying. That was written 125 years ago. So if we actually did that,
yeah,
do we actually have an encyclical from Pope Francis?
If we had listened to the Pope 125 years ago, if we would have listened to Jesus 2,000 years ago, I think we would, because I think we need constant reminder. I might be the only person in the room who suffers from this terrible proclivity to slip off the wagon. I know what the right thing is, but I don't always do the right thing. If we don't constantly reinforce and teach each other, then we will drift away, and we won't even know that we're drifting away from what we know to be the right thing to do. So yeah, I do. I think we constantly need teachers and prophets and reformers to remind us of our status. And besides that, Leo and most of the other encyclicals, all the way up to Centesimus Annus and John Paul II, all the way through, land is treated as a resource. None of these popes are thinking about the environment as intrinsically valuable that we have an obligation to save. So it's about time that the Pope focused specific attention just on this. It would have to happen anyway, in other words.
Can you say more about that?
About what?
About the idea that we haven't focused on the earth,
right,
and the planet,
and our
faith.
Okay. There's two ways of thinking about environmental ethics. One is anthropocentric, meaning we're concerned about the just distribution of the Earth's resources. We should protect them, we should distribute them justly, and we should make sure that they're available to future generations. This is a real, serious, and important ethic. And it's the dominant one in our American culture. There is a nascent view, ecocentrism, which talks about the intrinsic value of nature and how it should be regarded per ipse, for its own sake. The interesting thing about this argument, this ecocentric ethic, which I think a lot of people have an intuition for, but sort of a romanticized intuition for, that we can't really defend logically. We are attracted to it, but it's really hard to defend it. So I was out at the Nature Conservancy property, Broken Kettle, when I was doing research. It's in northwest Iowa. I was doing research for my dissertation. And I was there talking to this guy, Scott Motes, and Matt Gravy, Chad's brother, and the cool people. And there's a big plaque at Broken Kettle, and it lists 10 reasons why we should care about nature. And because it does this for us, because it does this for us. And it's like, oh my God, these are all anthropocentric reasons. And this is the Nature Conservancy talking. The 10th reason, get this, drum roll, because God put it there. The Nature Conservancy has to appeal to God to justify an ecocentric ethic. And as far as I can tell, there is no other rational justification for the intrinsic value of nature as valuable per ipse for its own sake, other than to say, it's not ours. It is its own thing. It is creation. Henry David Thoreau, who's a good friend of mine, but we fight sometimes. Thoreau says, he always uses the word nature with a capital N. That's his way of designating this thing as having intrinsic value. When religious people like the Pope talk about nature, they tend to use the word creation. It's crucial that we know that it is God's and not ours. And we are at best stewards of it.
Thanks. If we take a step back, because I think some people came here because on your bio you apparently almost ran over two saints.
Not at the same time. That was two different occasions.
Right. Could you share a little bit about this running into Mother Teresa and Pope John Paul II?
Okay, so I was living in Rome, and Mother Teresa was coming to the seminary to give a talk, and I was running late. Those who know me will be shocked to know that I was running late. So I'm flying down the stairs, and I burst through the doors to sprint down to the chapel where she's going to speak, and I burst through the doors just as she's walking by. So I almost have to do one of these baseballs sliding into home plate to avoid knocking over Mother Teresa. So that was awkward. But since I've actually, we corresponded later, so that was, yeah, that was cool. Then John Paul II. So I held his hat. I have 2.5 big regrets in my life. Mm-hmm. 2.5 big regrets. One
of
them is.
All of them?
What?
You're going to tell us all the 2.5?
Oh, there's one that's slightly inappropriate.
Okay. Maybe there's a little chump.
One of them is that when the Pope John Paul II came to Iowa, I held his hat. Mm-hmm. And I tell you this, I was going to try it on. And I had actually, you know, you pop it open and you flip the tails back and I looked and there were 30 bishops looking right at me. So I put that down on the table. But I wish I would have turned on his hat. Years later, I'm in Rome, I'm studying, and we go to meet the Pope. And I'm staying out of the way because, you know, I had the cool moment. You know, I was his altar boy. So I'm out of the way. And the Pope is there and all the guys, all my classmates are there and they're taking pictures. And the Pope walks down, steps off the staircase, and then turns around and says, "More pictures." And so everybody's scrambling to get as close to the Pope as they can get. And I'm just trying to stay out of the way, but I lost my balance and I started to fall. So I grabbed the person next to me to keep from falling over. And then I looked and it was the Pope. So there's this photograph of me with this grin. Like, oops, sorry about that. So yeah, I almost knocked down. Two saints. Yeah. So if you're going to be a saint, you want to stay away from me. That's the lesson.
Last month we had an important figure in our community visit us, Sister Loring Coffin, a Benedictine sister. And as we were driving back to the monastery, we were talking about this encyclical. It just came up. We were talking about different things that people are reading, and her statement was, there's 2 pages on the environment. It's about relationships.
Yeah, there's 2 pages on climate change.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's about relationships, and you've already mentioned that in some form or another, Pope Francis mentioned relationships almost 300 times.
Yeah.
Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, let's think this through. Can I play with them a little bit?
Sure.
Would you raise your hands if you think that there is a universal and necessary moral principle that everyone on the planet and everyone who's ever lived would agree to? Would you raise your hands if you think that's the case? Sorry?
You got to repeat it.
A moral principle that is so universal that you believe that everyone who has ever lived or anyone who lives anywhere on the planet would agree that this is a moral principle. Would you raise your hands? Okay. More than I'm used to seeing. Most people would say no. Now, if I were to play another game with you, we don't have time for it, but if you were to write down the 3 most important things in your life, the 3 most important things to you, are you thinking? One of them, I could use the word relationship, couldn't I? Are y'all nodding? Yeah. There it is. We all agree, and anybody who has ever lived would agree with us, that relationships are the most important thing in life. It's the only thing that matters. So let's examine, what does it mean, relationships? You have a relationship to yourself, and it dang well better be healthy, and if it's not, do something about it. You should love yourself. Not as much as I love myself, but you should love yourself. Then we should love one another. We should care for each other, starting with our families and our extended families and those people that are friends of ours whom we treat as family, which means we can take advantage of each other. And from there, we care about the stranger, and we care about, well, it includes the natural order. That's what the Pope is saying. We have a relationship with God's creation. And as a matter of fact, all of these relations in the composite, in the aggregate, constitute our relationship with God. We can't have a relationship with God if we don't have a relationship with God's creation. That's what the Pope is talking about. Thanks for playing, by the way.
So, the message is so simple, and it's easy to think about right now, but we leave here and go through our day, and it gets harder.
Yeah.
So what do we do?
Well, there's two things I want to say about that. I have friends who tell me, you always start out everything by saying, I have two things to say about that.
This went through my head.
Henry David Thoreau, he has three rules for caring for the environment. And those rules are, rule number one, simplify. Rule number two, simplify. Rule number three, simplify. Sometimes we humans have a capacity for making things more difficult than they really are, because then we allow ourselves slack for not doing it. So there's something that we need to take very seriously. I was in Assisi, but with a buddy of mine, and he needed. Anyway, I went into this shop, and there's this guy in there, and we're talking back and forth, and the guy says, "Oh, how come you speak Italian so well?" And he goes, "Well, I studied in Rome, and you know, I was ordained a priest." And this old guy that's in a shop full of trinkets that were all made in, you know, China or whatever, and he goes, "Oh, I'm going to be a priest." I'm like, "Oh, right, you are, you crazy old man." And I said, "So, what kind of priest are you going to be?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm going to be a Franciscan, of course." And I said, "Oh, being a Franciscan, following Francis, you know, that's such a hard lifestyle." And he goes, "Oh, it's not hard at all. You just do it." So I come storming out of that stupid junk shop, mad as heck, and thinking, that guy, I'm trying to live a Franciscan lifestyle, and I know how hard it is, and that guy's talking about how easy it is. And then I realized, oh, my God, that was Francis just there talking to me, telling me that it's a lot easier than I say it is, and just start doing it, buddy, and stop making excuses for not doing it. So there is that. The other side of the coin, it is hard. It's really complicated. I was talking to a young lady last night, and really, really smart and passionate and the kind of person that reminds you why we do what we do. And she was talking about what should we be eating and how should we be caring for the poor. And I thought, gosh, it's so complicated. We are all complicit. We want to blame the farmers. We're all complicit in the sins of the farmer. They wouldn't be doing what they are doing if they didn't want to feed their families, if they didn't want to pay their mortgages, if they didn't want to have a certain standard of living, which the rest of us also want. So when we buy products that they sell, that's on us. We can't just blame them. It's this network, this web of relationships, and I realize I'm drifting into that Walt Disney silly world of, you know, everything's related nonsense. But it is. We are all related. By the way, can I do a riff on, what is that, The Lion King? Have you all seen it? The opening scene where they hold up the baby lion and all the animals of the savannah sing hallelujah and they bow down on one knee, and I'm looking at this thinking, he's going to eat you. Why are you praising him? We should recognize that nature is not, we should not romanticize nature. We should be serious about understanding that nature is red in tooth and claw, as the poem goes. Robert Browning, is it? So we shouldn't romanticize nature. We should understand that every action is moral. I can't think of anything that we do that doesn't have a moral dimension to it, which is to say that there's a ripple effect. You do this and it sends a ripple out across this web of relationships, for better or for worse. We're not terribly good at it, but we are the best that there is, and we are good. And I believe in the goodness of humanity. I believe that people, when they know the right thing to do, they want to do it. It's just that it's so dang complicated, and when we've got loud voices screaming in our ears from different directions, trying to sway us in one way or another, it's really, really hard to cut through the noise, but we're capable of it, because we all know what relationships are, and we all value them.
So,
that, That was a total theoretical question that totally dodged any sort of practical on the ground real stuff.
Are you running for something?
running away from something right now.
So everybody's good, everybody simplifies, everybody
We do need to simplify, we need to consume less.
So everybody does all that.
Yeah.
In Paris, countries committed to all these things.
Yeah.
Does it actually matter? This course has been charted.
Okay.
We are going down a path.
Oh,
does it
God.
Matter? And more importantly, for everybody here right now, what can we do?
This is the part where people really get mad at me.
Okay, but we have a few more questions.
So I...
You've got to...
Speed it up?
Yeah.
Okay. We have an obligation to do the right thing. Whether there... And if there is something to be gained by doing the right thing, we better check the math, because it might not be the right thing to do. When we do the right thing environmentally, it is our duty, it is our obligation to do it. It won't make a dang bit of difference. Nothing any of us in this room do will make any difference.
What do you mean?
I'm sitting on an airplane. For whatever reason, this is years ago when they still did this. They didn't let us off the plane because we're going to continue on. So I'm looking out the window. I'm seeing the garbage being taken off of our last flight as they put the new stuff on for the next flight. And I'm watching these bags of garbage go off this little regional flight. I'm thinking, that's more trash than I will recycle in years. My recycling is not going to make a difference. What you and I do as individuals won't make a difference. That's not the point. As a matter of fact, the desire to make a difference is a trap. We should do it because it's the right thing to do, not because we think it's going to make a difference. The other side of that coin, the Pope says very explicitly, this international cooperation, the Paris summit, is the only place where enough can be done that will actually make a difference. Mitigate and adapt, not reverse trajectory. The plane's going down. The question now is it going to be a soft landing or a hard landing? But the economy as it is run, our use of resources as we are currently doing it, that has to end. You and I can't do it. It has to be done at the level of international cooperation. And I'm hopeful because I believe that Paris is going to be marked as the birthday of the world when we decided to save it.
So what do?
We
as people.
We consume less, period. We consume less of everything. And I hate to put it to you this way because it sounds so political, but I am from Iowa and, you know, we just messed up your lives for the next several months. We got to elect people who will do what is right in our name, even though it will not be easy. Talked earlier about this idea of redistributive suffering. We have to be able to admit that we're going to have to spend more and get less back. We have to reduce our standard of living. But you guys, you all know this. You know the difference between standard of living and quality of life, don't you? And you all prefer quality of life to standard of living, don't you? And they're not equatable. By the way, I'm not an idiot. I know that you need a certain standard of living to put a roof over your head. But we know that what's really important to us is not what we own, but the quality of our relationships.
So, in preparation for today, I kept thinking of a phrase, which I'll pronounce this way and be corrected, but mitako. Mitakwa Sen. All my relations from the Lakota, and I've totally butchered that, so no disrespect. The value of a spirituality so I've been thinking about this phrase, and I've been thinking about the encyclical. And this phrase, my understanding, means all my relations. This phrase has been here for centuries before Catholics had been here, or Christians. And you've referenced the beautiful language that Pope Francis has talked about, relationships, in this encyclical.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, have the Lakota people been expressing this for centuries, and the Pope has simply written it beautifully for Christians?
I believe that's the case. I mean, that's the simplest and easiest answer. That phrase, which I won't try to say out loud either.
You can say it, but you say it better
than mine. I don't, Metakwiowasan is how I pronounce it, but I don't know how to pronounce it. That phrase, all my relations, it pulls in the four directions, the earth, the sky, really the six grandfathers, as Dumaly phrases it, right? It pulls in everything, and it helps us to recognize that we exist in this constellation of relationships. And we're not the center. We're just one of those orbiting around this central gravitational power, which I would say is God. And that is a very modest and a very humble admission of our place in the scheme of things. And yet it's a celebration of our connectedness to everything else. So the Pope is, as a matter of fact, Laudato Si literally means may you be praised. It's in Italian, by the way. It's not in Latin. This is the first encyclical, I think, it's the first encyclical that the title of which is not in Latin. And it's the first line of St. Francis's Prayer of All Creation. Now, there's a reason why St. Francis is really popular when the missionaries went out, because Native Americans would say, well, I don't understand this Jesuit stuff, but you Franciscans, we get Francis, right? So this idea is universal, I think. But still, the Pope had to say it. But I would say that Laudato Si is really translated as we are all related. I think that's really the title or the core message of the encyclical.
We asked folks that attended if they had questions. One of the questions reads this way. In some cases, science and spirituality seem to converge at a point that encourages people not to worry about the environment. Science often points to broad cycles of climate change despite evidence of human influence. And spirituality sometimes points to God's greater plan for beyond human control or understanding. How would you respond?
Oh, I'm going to get in more trouble. First of all, yes, climate change is cyclical, and we know that a lot of what's going on here outside today is probably caused by El Nino, not by anthropogenic climate change, anthropogenic human cause. So it's really, really hard to know exactly what we are responsible and what is just a natural occurrence. But the overwhelming evidence is that it is what's going on in nature is far above what we would expect to be happening if it was just nature doing its cyclical variations, which of course it does. So we have to admit, we don't have to do anything, but it would be a really good idea for us to admit that we have a problem and we should do something about it, even if it's just erring on the side of caution. Besides that, there's overwhelming scientific consensus on this. The few voices who oppose this follow the money. They're traced back to two sources. I won't name them, but they sell oil. And they are spending multiple millions of dollars a year in order to try to convince people, and they're doing a dang good job of it, that there is some doubt about anthropogenic climate change. But there is none as far as the scientific community is concerned. In terms of a religious response, this idea that God has this overarching plan for us, okay, I'm going to play with them one more time because I know we're almost out of time. Raise your hand if you're one of these people who has all of your relationships so thoroughly worked out, they're so mapped out, they're so perfect, that everything is exactly the way you want it. It's frozen in amber forever. Would you raise your hands? What is wrong with you, you bunch of sinners? Right? The point is that relationships aren't something to be achieved. Relationships aren't something that are accomplished, right? Relationships are something which are lived. And the greatest thing about relationships is how they are constantly shifting. I call it dynamic equilibrium, which also happens in nature, which is interesting. We are constantly shifting and adjusting to one another. We're growing, we're messing up, we're fixing it. But we're always, just like this chair that I'm sitting on, we're always moving, right? That's the nature of relationships. I would like to suggest to you that it's less about God's plan for us and much, much more about our relationship with God. If we have a relationship with God, we don't need to worry so much about the plan, but we do need to worry about our relationships, including that which we have with God's creation.
One final question.
Good, because I need coffee.
So, if none of us, if we recycle everything we can recycle, if we simplify, if we do everything we've just talked about and you've shared, it won't impact anything. So is there hope?
Yeah. So I'm sitting in the office of Rosemary Radford Ruther. She's a Roman Catholic feminist theologian, which makes her pretty rare. She invented a thing called ecofeminism. So I'm sitting in her office interviewing her, and so my last question was that. I said, Dr. Ruford, are you hopeful? And we're sitting in her office, and we're drinking instant coffee out of chipped mugs that said World Greatest Grandma, and she's got her glasses on, and she stops and she goes, Bud, don't ever let the bastards get you down. Which is a little disconcerting, because grandma shouldn't use such language. You are a saint. And I say that with some authority.
Watch out, he may run you down.
People accuse me of not listening.
It won't make... What we are doing, what we do as individuals, what we do as persons, isn't going to make a difference, and it shouldn't matter. But we should just do it because it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do when we do it. We don't worry about the consequences. And I this is going to sound a little bit like a cop-out, but look, if you think God has a plan, then fine. Don't worry about it. Let God work out God's plan. You do your bit. You do what you know to be right. We do what we know to be right. And don't worry so much about whether it's going to make a difference. I do believe that there's this temptation to want to make a difference. My students always at this point say, wait, so why do you bother getting up in the morning? And the answer is, well, this, of course. But you get up in the morning and you do what you do because you know what the right thing to do is, and you do it. And there is a contentment in that. There is can I tell that story?
Sure.
So we're on a mountain in Italy visiting a group of convented nuns. They live in a monastery up in this mountain. They're super cool women, so I wanted people to meet them. So I took Matt and, you know, guys, maybe know Ted, and we went up on this mountain, and Matt asked this young nun a question. He said, so why do you like St. Ambrose of Milan so much? And she gave an answer. She freaked out, and she went to the morning prayers to give an answer, but you could tell she wasn't really happy with her answer. So she came back, and she said to Matt, she goes, what I really like about St. Ambrose, I'm doing all the translating because she doesn't speak English, she goes, what I really like about St. Ambrose is his equilibrio. You hear it, don't you? When we do the right thing, when we know what, when we discern what the right thing is to do, as flawed as that might be, and then we do it, we know, we have this sense of tranquility, this sense of integrity, this sense of harmony, this sense of equilibrium, that allows us to know that our relationships are going well. Don't worry about making a difference. Just do what you know to be the right thing to do, and it will take care of itself. Hope. Hope is not what we think it is. Hope is, I really hope that the coffee doesn't run out. I really hope that this guy shuts up soon because I got to get to work. I really hope. That's what we call hope. That's not what hope is. Hope is, okay, I really hope that wouldn't happen, but it did. It won't win. Hope is the understanding that when the worst thing that could happen does happen, it does not prevail. This is belief, clinging to, hanging on to. And this is faith, letting go. Faith is letting go. Hope is trusting that when the worst thing that could happen does happen, it does not prevail. And what's the third? Faith, hope, and? There you are. Relationships.
on that, but thank you for coming out. So I've known Bud half my life.
You poor thing.
Yeah. And I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you've been asked to speak all over and have done so to share your thoughts, to share your scholarly work internationally, and just really grateful to you for coming out and being with us tonight, or today and last night, and we've got some more meetings, but you've got a piece of artwork from the Black Hills Works Susie Keppel Art Center here in Rapid City. Hopefully it finds a place either in your farmhouse or your office. But thank you, Bud, for taking the time and being with us.
Thank you, man. Thank you all. Thank you.